A look inside our reader's portfolio, the collapse of the People's Trust and buying overseas shares. You're listening to the Personal Finance Show with me, Kate Bealey. Today, I'm joined by Richard Parkin, Head of Pensions Policy at Fidelity International. And we're going to start by looking at this week's portfolio clinic. So we've had a reader write in. This is Kate, a 51-year-old self-employed physiotherapist, and she wants to retire on an income of $13,000 a year. But will her pot be enough to generate that? So Richard, our reader wants to retire in 15 years. Now, she's asking if she should just be focusing on income-generating shares alone to get the benefit of that reinvested income in her SIP.
In terms of what her real investment horizon is, it may well be that it's longer than 15 years, because the implication is she's probably going to stay invested through retirement. So although retirement may happen in 15 years, she could find that she'll be living on the portfolio for another 20 or even 30 years beyond that. So taking an overly cautious investment approach at this stage may not serve her well. Certainly, income-generating funds, even if you're not taking an income, do have a benefit of moderating downside risk. So things like equity income tend to have less risk of falling, and that's very important when you're drawing money down. But ahead of that, if she is, and it looks like she has got quite a strong appetite for risk, there's probably worth pursuing a more growth-oriented strategy.
Okay. How, she mentioned strategies like drip feeding. How can investors kind of maximise growth in their SIPs using those kind of strategies?
Yeah, so in terms of drip feeding, I guess the key thing for maximising any form of pension investment is just get as much into the wrapper as possible, into the pensions wrapper. So it's not really an investment strategy, more a saving strategy. We do see that people leave a lot of their annual pension allowance unused, even if they've got other investments. And just a reminder of what the rule is there. You would normally have a £40,000 annual allowance each year for your SIP. You have to have a sufficient earnings, so you've got to have more than 40,000 earnings in order to make the full contribution. If you've got less than, you can only contribute as 100% of your earnings. But you don't need to take all your pay and put it in. So if you've got ISA investments, say, and particularly if you're reasonably close to retirement, you might use those to fund pension contributions, on the grounds that if you do need to get your hands on the money once you hit 55, you can now. So we think there's a lot more scope for people to just manage their wrappers and move money between them.
Okay, but the lesson is just get in as much as you can.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as in this case, she's some way off achieving her retirement goal, so she's going to need to make as best she can out of all the tax allowances that are available to her.
Yeah, we'll come to how realistic it is in a minute. Yeah. But before that, she's very keen on the idea of investing in a Bitcoin investment trust. How do you think people should approach very high risk investments like this? How much of a SIP should they ever take up in this kind of position?
Right. So, well, I mean, I think the general rule for any high risk investment is you should only invest what you're prepared to lose completely. I know there's a lot of talk about diversification in your magazine, and that's a great strategy. And whilst an investment trust might diversify across Bitcoin investments, it's clearly all exposed to the Bitcoin market. So even in that, I don't think diversification is going to reduce the risk too much. So, it depends what her attitude is, but I would suggest that should just be a small part of her portfolio.
Yeah. And so she said she wants an income of $13,000 a year. Just how big would your portfolio need to be, theoretically, to achieve that kind of income, given where we are with inflation and that kind of thing? What kind of return are you needing?
Yeah, so if we're looking, if we look at what she'd need to have at age 65 to support that, I guess the starting point is, if you're looking to create a lifetime income at that level and have it inflation protected, the only way you're going to be able to guarantee to do that is to buy an inflation-linked annuity. If we look at where rates are today, it's about 3.5% a year on what you invest into one of those. So you, more or less, you'd need 30 times your starting income. So she needs probably nearly £400,000 in order to get a guaranteed lifetime income. But that's just the starting point. if you move away from that and accept that you're going to have to take some risk, and it does sound she's got some other sources of income, so that may be an okay thing to do, you can then start looking at investment strategies, which of course won't be guaranteed either in terms of lasting your lifetime or in terms of matching inflation, but certainly should do. So the thing that is interesting here and we see a lot of is that often people talk about how much you can withdraw from your SIP in a way that gives you a very high chance of not running out of money. And that's fine, but it also means there's a very high chance you'll leave a lot of money when you die. So this idea of the
people being too cautious.
Well, yeah, so the 4% rule, or as Morningstar might have you say, now it's a 3% rule because of where we are with inflation. That's great, but it's important to recognise those strategies are designed so that if you keep doing that, there's a high chance you won't run out of money. I think perhaps, and particularly for those customers who are prepared to take a bit more risk and have a bit more flexibility, it might make sense to say, well, I'll start off taking a higher level of income, but if markets don't go very well, then I will take a bit less. If they do well, then I can afford to take a bit more.
So you think people should be kind of flexible in their approach to how much they take every year?
I think that's where you have to be with drawdown with any form of investment income. If you just keep blindly taking the same amount of money out of a portfolio, then yes, there is a risk that you'll eventually run into ruin. The danger with being super cautious, of course, is, you know, if you get to 75 and you've still got loads of money in your portfolio, you may not be healthy enough to spend it. Generally, people tend to want to spend more money at the start of their retirement and less later on. So something that gives you a big pot of money later in life may not be helpful. May help you pay for long-term care, but if that's not the aim, then chance that you don't get the retirement that you've saved so hard for.
Okay, so this person's portfolio currently stands at 92, a bit over, almost 93,000. Pounds. So how much do you think she would really need to grow that by over 15 years?
Well, so you know, if we look at that, the target of 400,000, she's clearly a long way from that. And certainly on investment growth alone, that just doesn't seem feasible. Because, of course, as well as growing to that number, you've got to counter inflation. So she needs to get a real return that would be probably into double digits in order to achieve that.
And
so,
what do you think a kind of realistic real return is for a balanced portfolio?
Well, it's yes, for a balanced portfolio, I probably in the range of sort of 3% now, I would think, would be any more aggressive than that would be overly optimistic.
Right.
What's not clear from this, though, is what are the contributions she's intending to make over the next 15 years, because that's still a good long time to top up your pension if she has got opportunity to bring other investments and get some of that that tax relief benefit. She may find that gives her a boost as well. But on the face of it looks like she may
pretty tough ask.
But of course she is still talking about retiring at 65, which I know many of us will want to do. Increasingly, that's becoming less common, and certainly in 15 years, the state pension age will be not quite at 68, but certainly 67. So there will be a trend for people to retire a bit later or carry on working beyond that.
Yeah. So I want to actually move away from the portfolio now and just talk a bit about what's happening with pensions, as the city regulator has been stepping in quite a lot recently and making some quite severe warnings about things related to pension freedoms, for example, and certainly pension transfers. So the FCA has said that it's investigating pension freedoms. What are they looking into now?
Yeah, so the FCA has been put in an incredibly difficult position with pension freedom. You know, it's always difficult regulating such a complex market, and of course the FCA were concerned about some of the things that were going on before pension freedom came in, but suddenly they've been asked to police a market where people can do anything, and they are doing all sorts of things. So the FCA is in some ways trying to play a bit of catch up and understand what people are doing and really whether they're making the right choices, and even if they're not making the right choices, whether they actually understand the choices they are making. So the work that the FCA is doing is something called the Retirement Outcomes Review, and is if you like, looking at the market. They spend a lot of time talking to providers like Fidelity and talking to customers and just understanding or just finding out what they understood when they made the choices. And they have identified a few areas where they're concerned. So we'll just maybe kind of run through those. So they... they surprisingly, in my view, seemed to be quite comfortable at where people were taking cash and just emptying their pension accounts, that generally people weren't making completely daft choices there. People understood that. I was surprised. I think there are some people who are perhaps paying more tax, and we know that there's a lot of people who are just taking cash because they can, because they're frightened the government are going to change the rules again. The other thing they're worried about is people. There's a lot more people going into income drawdown or pension drawdown now, and there's a concern that that is quite a complex product, and do people really understand it? Now, I won't get into the technical detail, but a lot of the people who are going into drawdown are doing that because they're just taking their tax-free cash. And there's a big question about, if I'm just taking my tax-free cash, do I really need to understand all of the complexities of drawdown?
Because what the other option would be, that you just take the lump sum and then leave the rest
of
it.
And that's what. So if I look at Fidelity customers, probably about two-thirds to three-quarters of our customers who go into drawdown are just taking tax-free cash and are not taking any income. So effectively, it's just like taking a bit of money out of your savings. Where drawdown gets really complicated is when you are trying to take this sort of regular income and trying to make it last. So the FCA is right to be worried, but again, they need to think about, well, what are people trying to do? And then the final sort of concern is, in terms of what customers are doing, is people don't seem to be shopping around. So they tend to be taking money just from their existing plan rather than trying to move around. And again, if people are going into drawdown to take income, then that might be a concern. If they're just taking tax-free cash and carrying on saving, then the fact they're not moving may not be a worry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And we are hearing a lot as well, aren't we, about ill-advised final salary pension transfers. And this is people, what, kind of cashing in basically a final salary guaranteed pension in order to take a big sum of money.
Yeah.
Is that a good explanation?
Yeah, it is. And there's a number of drivers. So the fact is, defined benefit pensions are great. They give people lots of certainty. But the benefits that they pay may not be exactly what somebody wants. So in particular, we're finding this with the baby boomers. People may have a number of final salary schemes, and actually they don't need that much guaranteed income. So a number of people are saying, well, actually, I'd like the idea of having pension freedom and being able to take some cash. And a lot of people saying, I'm quite worried that I might die before I get, value for my pension. I'd like to leave something behind. So that's what's driving people. On top of that, because interest rates are relatively low, when you ask for what we call transfer value, which says what you get instead of your pension, the numbers are huge. People with a £25,000 pension are being shown numbers that might be £800,000-£900,000, and so they're actually putting a lot of pressure on advisors, saying, "I want to transfer. Give me positive advice." And again, advisors are in a bit of a tricky place here because customers are getting very insistent. So FCA is looking at that. They are being very active. They have suspended a number of advisors where they're not happy about what's going on. But more broadly, they've just published a consultation about what good transfer value, transfer advice looks like. And that's about really understanding what somebody's situation is and what options they have. So if we go back to that idea about people wanting to move their pension so they can leave something behind for loved ones, another way of solving that problem might be to say, well, take your defined benefit pension and use some of the income for that to buy a life insurance policy. So it sounds simple, but you can achieve the same thing. And so just trying to make sure advisors are thinking around, the other alternatives.
Yeah, because I guess the sum of money might look huge, mightn't it? But that does have to last you for your entire lifetime, and you're giving up guarantees, aren't you?
Indeed. And going back to where we came in on the case study, the fact that just a £13,000 income, if you want that guaranteed for life with inflation proofing, which is what you get with most defined benefit pension plans, that costs you nearly £400,000. You can see that the bottom line here is that guaranteed lifetime income that keeps pace with inflation is expensive, whether it's in a defined benefit scheme. So you shouldn't kid yourself that you can just take the money out and be massively better off. Sound investing and good advice may get you there. And if you're sick or you're single or sadly both of those, then you may find that you get more flexibility and a better income overall. But for a lot of people, it's going to be better to stay put. And if just one more point I'd make on that, it's important that people recognise that when an advisor tells them that they shouldn't transfer, that is valuable advice. Yeah. saying that, oh, you know, I've had bad advice because they didn't tell me I could transfer. Well, actually, the advisor's told you a sensible financial decision to make, and that's as valuable as one to move.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Richard. That's all very helpful stuff. At the end of the show, we'll be looking at the collapse of the People's Trust. But before that, we're going to take a look at overseas shares and why you might want to hold them. I'm joined now by Emma Adjiman, personal finance writer. Emma, why would somebody want to hold overseas shares?
Well, the simple reason is that there are lots of exciting, fast-growing companies that are not listed in the UK, unfortunately. The most obvious are the tech stocks, which have done really well in the last few years. The US companies, the so-called FANGs, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix and Google. But also the Asian tech giants like Samsung, Tencent and Alibaba.
OK, so I mean, why couldn't you just buy the same companies in the UK?
Simply because they're not listed on UK exchanges. And actually, since the sale of Arm to a Japanese company recently, there are much fewer options for investors who want to access technology companies in the UK.
OK, so are there other benefits of holding overseas shares?
The key benefit, I think, is probably diversification, because you get the UK market is quite concentrated, has quite a high number of financials and oil and gas companies. Other exchanges have different kinds of companies on there. So if you want to get a broader exposure to different kinds of companies, and in particular technology companies, it's a good reason to look abroad.
OK, and what about currency? Is that a benefit, a risk, or both?
It can be both. It really depends on how the pound performs against the other currency. So if the pound strengthens against another currency, the value of shares in the other currency are going to be worth less once translated back into sterling. But if, as has happened in the last year, the pound weakens, then the value of shares in overseas currencies, you know, will be worth more once translated back.
OK, so definitely not something to bank on either way. And can anyone hold overseas shares? How do you buy them?
You can buy international shares in North American and European markets through most brokers and platforms. But if you want to go further afield to places like Asia, there are fewer brokers and platforms that allow you to do that.
OK, so what are the issues with doing this? Are there tax issues?
There are definitely risks to holding overseas shares. I mean, we've already spoken about currency, which can go against you. But there's also the issue of tax, as you bring up, because there's potential to be taxed twice on the income that you receive from overseas shares, both in the UK and in the country that the shares are based in.
OK, so how are US stocks treated for tax purposes? Because those are quite special, aren't they?
Yes. So the UK has a number of double agreement treaties with other countries, which should mean that investors can claim back the amount of tax that they pay on overseas shares. And in the US, if you're an overseas investor, a UK investor, as long as you fill in a form, the W8BEN form, you can reduce the amount of tax that you'll pay from 30% to 15%.
Okay, brilliant. Are there any other issues surrounding holding overseas shares?
Well, it just depends on where you're actually investing, because some companies in different markets, for example, emerging markets, might have less good transparency or reporting standards. And there might be an increased risk of political changes, political instability. So that's something else investors need to bear in mind.
OK, so when it comes to actually buying these, you said that not all brokers will let you buy overseas shares. Do the ones that do they charge extra?
Yes, they do. So most platforms will charge a foreign exchange fee on top of a standard dealing fee to trade a share.
OK, and what kind of charge could you expect to pay then? Does it vary quite widely?
It does. But in general, most platforms will have a fixed standard fee and they'll charge a percentage for foreign exchange. And that can go up to 1.5%, which is pretty steep, considering that if you're buying £10,000 of shares, you're just spending £150 just for the foreign exchange conversion.
OK, so what kind of broker charges the least?
Well, Dutch online broker DEGIRO is actually charging the lowest fees across the industry, and they allow you to trade across 25 different markets. So you can trade US shares. It costs 50 cents, and that's in euros, plus $0.004 per share. And to trade European shares, it charges €4 plus 0.04% per trade. So quite low rates there.
Yeah. Now, how are they doing that? How are they charging such low amounts?
Well, they say they're able to do it because, unlike most brokers, they don't run any of their systems via third parties. and they run all their settlement, clearing, trading and ITE systems in-house.
Okay. So for more on all of that and for a full table on the different costs and how to hold overseas shares cheaply, take a look at the magazine. But finally, we're going to turn to the People's Trust. It launched with a great fanfare over a year ago, but now the dream appears to be over. The trust was set to IPO this month, but it collapsed this week amid a lack of demand. Emma, what was this trust?
Well, the People's Trust, as you were saying, was trying to raise a minimum of £50 million to list on the London Stock Exchange. And it would have been a multi-manager fund with a focus on sustainable wealth creation.
OK, so what was it trying to do that was different?
Well, I mean, one of the key differences about this fund was that it was trying to sort of break out of a short-termist that defines much of the industry. And it was actually championed by Daniel Godfrey, who is the former chief executive of the Investment Association. It was trying to do a number of things. One of the ways it was trying to tackle that short-term thinking was by giving an external fund manager 7-year contracts, which is much longer than the usual amount. And the other interesting thing it did was that it crowdfunded all its startup costs from the general public rather than going through an institution.
Because it was trying to be kind of independent?
Or? Yes, because it was trying to be independent and, as a sort of title suggests, be a trust run by the people, for the people.
Okay. So I think you mentioned there how much Daniel was hoping to raise. How much did he need to raise and how much did he raise?
Sure. Well, it was looking to raise a minimum of £50 million to list. But in the event, he didn't give an exact figure for how much they did raise, but it was obviously below that. And he said that the trust was on track to reach the halfway point, which suggests of something around £25 million.
OK. Why did he fail to get over the line then? What was his reason for that lack of demand?
Well, the key thing really was that there was not enough money raised from institutions and wealth managers, although the trust was quite well supported amongst retail investors. But obviously retail investors have less capital than institutions. And then without the institutional backing, it just wasn't enough for this trust to go forward.
OK, so why do people say it didn't appeal then?
Well, there are a number of reasons. Wealth managers may not have liked the trust because as a multi-manager fund, it was choosing fund managers externally, which is actually something similar to what wealth managers do themselves. So in some sense, it wasn't really a natural fit for that audience. And also other people were put off by the fact that managers were being offered 7-year contracts because you could be stuck with a poor performing manager for a really long time. Others also felt it was quite similar to trusts that were available in the market already. There are actually two other multi-manager funds, Witten and Alliance Trust, and both of them are cheaper than the People's Trust would have been.
Okay. And were there complaints as well about the asset allocation model, what you ended up with?
Yes. I mean, basically the way that the trust would have worked was that it was going to be split over 5 different areas. And some commentators felt that, you know, that's a kind of arbitrary
having
number.
An even amount in each didn't work.
Mm.
So what is Daniel saying? Is he going to try again or is he going to leave this alone?
At the moment, he has no plans, but he didn't rule out trying again in the future.
OK, thanks, Emma. Well, that's all we've got time for this week. So for everything we've discussed, pick up the magazine. Otherwise, we'll catch you at the same time next week. Have a good weekend.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.